Chapter 45, On Pilgrimage. According to the Maha Parinibbana Sutta, or the Sutta of the Great Passing, the Buddha, shortly before his death, told Ananda, his disciple and constant companion, that there were four places, the sight of which should arouse emotion in the faithful. These were the place where he was born, the place where he attained supreme enlightenment, the place where he set in motion the wheel of the Dharma, in other words, first taught the truth he had discovered, and the place where he finally passed beyond mundane existence. During my years in India, I had visited all four sacred sites, now known respectively as Rumindei, Bodh Gaya, Sarnath, and Kusinara. The first and second I had visited twice, the third and fourth at least five or six times, so my memories of both Sarnath and Bodh Gaya were of a composite nature, and it was not always possible for me to tell what I had done or whom I had met on which visit. In the case of Sarnath, however, blurred and blended though my memories of subsequent visits may have been, I had a vivid recollection of my first visit to the place, a recollection that was all the more vivid for the experience itself having been, in one important respect, so painful. The year was 1949, the month Vaishakha, or April-May, the hottest month in the Indian calendar. With my friend and companion Satyapriya, formerly Robin Banerjee, I arrived in Sarnath one morning, the pair of us having walked all the way from Varanasi. The reason for our walking there, despite the intense heat, was that we were observing the rule of not handling money, and therefore were not in a position to hire a taxi or cycle rickshaw. For the last 2 years we had been freelance wandering ascetics, living on alms, studying and meditating, and testing in various ways our readiness to take formal ordination as Buddhist monks. Convinced that we were, in fact, now ready, we had travelled from South India, via Bombay, to Sarnath. At Sarnath, we knew there was a branch of the Mahabodhi Society of India, and a community of Theravadin Buddhist monks, and from these monks we hoped to receive ordination. We were cruelly disappointed. On our arrival, footsore and weary, we were received in an unfriendly, even hostile manner, grudgingly accommodated and fed, and refused ordination with flimsy excuses, which, we later discovered, were no better than lies. We were therefore forced to seek ordination elsewhere. But that is another story. During the next 15 or 16 years, I visited Sarnath a number of times, and this way came to know the Mahabodhi Society monks reasonably well. There were five or six of them altogether, only one of whom was Indian, the rest being Sinhalese. Some of them later apologised for the way that they had treated Satyapriya and me. Hindus who only wanted to be financially supported were coming and asking for ordination all the time, they explained, and they could not be too careful. The first to apologise was the Venerable M. Sangharatana, the Mahabodhi Society's bhikkhu in charge at Sarnath, who from the first had been less unfriendly than the other members of the little monastic community. Though impulsive to the point of rashness, and far too outspoken for his own good, he was a warm-hearted man, with a stronger feeling for the Dharma than most of his fellow monks, and over the years an increasingly cordial relationship had developed between us. As it happened, the first person Terry and I met on emerging from the taxi that had brought us to Sarnath and to the door of the Mahabodhi Society was none other than the lean, excitable Sangharatana. He was glad to see me and at once showed us to our room in the big pink sandstone rest house where we were to stay. After we had settled in and had taken a stroll in the pleasant park-like area on the other side of the road, I went and paid my respects to the chief monk. This was the Venerable Sasanasiri, a corpulent, jovial, easygoing man of about 60 who occupied a room on the same floor of the building. I found him lying in bed. He was suffering from high blood pressure, he told me, and the doctor had ordered him to take a complete rest. Though he spoke cheerfully, I noticed that his face had an ashen look and that the monks who were caring for him seemed anxious. One of these monks was quiet, scholarly Dhammaratana, a colleague of mine on the editorial board of the Mahabodhi Journal, who was usually to be found in Calcutta. From him I learned that the Venerable Jagdish Kashyap, with whom I had studied Pali, Abhidharma and logic, was now at Nalanda. This was good news, for I wanted not only to see my old teacher, but also to tell him that I had decided that my future lay in the West. Nalanda, in any case, was one of the places Terry and I were planning to visit on our way to Calcutta, and, eventually, Kalimpong, the little town in the eastern Himalayas where I had lived for 14 years, a third of my life. Terry and I spent 9 or 10 days in Sarnath, dividing our time mainly between explorations of the extensive archaeological area and expeditions into Varanasi. The principal object of interest in the archaeological area was the still-standing portion of the monolithic column on which was inscribed, in Brahmi letters, the edict in which the Emperor Ashoka warns the members of the monastic community against schism. We also circumambulated the massive Damek stupa, which marked the spot where the Buddha sat to give his first teaching, thus setting in motion the wheel of the Dharma. Visited the Sarnath Museum, saw the room in the Burmese temple where I had received my ordination as a bhikshu, and studied the Ajanta-style frescoes in the Mula Gandakuti Vihara, the pink sandstone temple built by Anigarika Dhammapala, the founder of the Mahabodhi Society. In colourful, chaotic Varanasi, there naturally was much more to see, though little or nothing of Buddhist interest or significance, the ancient city having long been a stronghold of Orthodox Hinduism. Like most visitors, we saw the Durga temple with its unfriendly mother monkeys, the beautiful, dazzlingly white marble mausoleum of Swami Bhaskarananda, a 19th century Hindu ascetic, and the dusty, dilapidated Bharat Mata Mandir, or Temple of Mother India, where the object of worship, so to speak, was a huge contour model of the subcontinent. On one occasion we hired a boat and spent a couple of hours being rowed slowly past the famous ghats or bathing places, on the crumbling steps of which Brahmin priests sat performing rituals beneath huge mushroom-like umbrellas, where dead bodies were being cremated, apparently with very little ceremony, where washermen were banging and slapping clothes and beggars soliciting alms, and from the safety of which pilgrims of all ages were taking their ceremonial dip in the sacred, sin-absolving waters. Wedged between the ghats were domed and pinnacled temples innumerable, some of them tilted at such a rakish angle due to subsidence that they looked as though they might slip or topple over into the Ganges at any minute. Once we stayed longer in the city than usual, so that by the time we left, the moon had risen, and we made the journey back to Sarnath by moonlight. It was a full moon, so bright that Terry tried, unsuccessfully, to take a picture of it through the leaves of one of the wayside Bodhi trees. Most evenings I joined Sangharatana and the other monks for the 6:30 puja, as I was accustomed to do when staying at Sarnath. The puja took place in the sanctuary, as it might be termed, that occupied the far end of the Mula Gandakuti Vihara's single nave, and was on a slightly higher level. We sat in a row in front of the white marble image table, cross-legged, and in order of seniority, with the more senior in ordination on the right and the more junior on the left. Over the years, I had moved up along the row, and more often than not, there would be more monks sitting on my left than on my right. The puja consisted of the chanting in Pali of the three refuges and the verses for offering flowers, lights, and incense, followed by the Mangala, Karaniya Metta, and Ratana suttas, and verses invoking the blessings of the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, as well as of the Devas or Shining Ones. I always enjoyed the chanting, especially when Sangharasana was present, for despite his emaciated appearance, his narrow chest and his ever-troublesome liver, he possessed a magnificent bass voice to which the temple's acoustics did full justice. The puja concluded with a short period of meditation, the length of which was determined, as was the chanting led, by the senior-most monk. We then sat quietly for a few minutes before dispersing. I always took the opportunity of gazing up at the great golden figure on the image table, which, except for the fact that it was gilded, was an exact replica of a 5th century sculpture in the Sarnath Museum. The Buddha was depicted seated, eyes half closed, and with hands exhibiting the mudra of setting in motion the wheel of the Dharma. He had set that sublime wheel in motion, had first taught the truth he had discovered here in Sarnath. He was at a spot only a few dozen yards away that he had addressed his first 5 disciples, who initially were unwilling to give him a hearing. These disciples, and the hundreds of others who became his disciples in the years that followed, passed on what they had learnt to their disciples, they to theirs, and so on. In this way, the Buddha's teaching had spread, first through the Indian subcontinent, then throughout the rest of Asia. Now, 25 centuries after the Buddha's Parinirvana, that same teaching was beginning to spread. The Dharma wheel was beginning to roll from the east to the west. I was part of the process. Having spent 20 years in the east, 14 of them working for the good of Buddhism in Kalimpong, as directed by Kashyapji, I was about to return permanently to the west to work for the good of Buddhism there. What form that work would take, I did not know. Little did I suspect, sitting there and gazing up at the golden, wheel-turning Buddha, that there was even then in train a series of events that would have the effect by the end of the year of making clear to me what needed to be done. The laity did not take part in the puja. They sat on the marble floor of the nave, listening to the chanting of the monks, or with hands clasped together as though in prayer, recited verses of their own under their breath. Some prostrated themselves from time to time, others chatted quietly, or allowed their eyes to wander to the frescoes depicting episodes in the life of the Buddha that decorated these side walls. Most were pilgrims from the Buddhist countries of Southeast Asia, and they came in family groups and accompanied by their own yellow-robed or brown-robed monks, who, if there were not too many of them, were sometimes invited to join the resident monks in the sanctuary. More than once in the course of the week, I was asked to give a talk for their benefit immediately after the puja, which I did in the traditional manner, that is, seated on a higher level than my auditors, and concluded with the customary blessings. Terry did not always attend the evening puja. He had little interest in ritual, and in any case, during our stay in Sarnath, he was often depressed, sometimes quite badly, and did not feel like seeing much of other people. One evening, only one or two of the resident monks turned up for the puja. All the others were with Venerable Sasanasiri, who was seriously ill. The following morning, on returning to the rest house from the deserted refectory, I learned that he had died the previous night on the way to hospital, his very high blood pressure having resulted in a heart attack. The funeral procession left from the rest house at 9:30, exactly 12 hours after the chief monk's death. Before it left, I went along to his room to pay my last respects, and Terry, at Sangharatana's request, took photographs of the body for dispatch to the Sri Lankan papers, afterwards commenting in his diary, "Interesting but macabre." Several hundred people took part in the procession, which was a colourful affair, including as it did not only the yellow-robed monks on and around the decorated vehicle carrying the corpse, but also a number of red-robed Tibetan monks with their drums and other musical instruments, Sinhalese and Burmese pilgrims holding five-coloured Buddhist flags, and students from the Mahabodhi High School. The cremation took place on a hillock near Sarnath Railway Station. Soon the flames were leaping up from the pyre, and within minutes the heat was so intense that everyone had to withdraw to a distance of a dozen or more yards, especially as it was now midday, and to the heat of the flames there was added the scorching heat of the sun, which blazed down upon the scene from a sky of cloudless blue. In the afternoon, Terry and I went into Varanasi, where we walked along the riverside for a while, bought 6 rosaries of black seeds, and made up for having had no breakfast and only a very small lunch by treating ourselves to a meal at the quality restaurant. Besides exploring the archaeological area and going on expeditions into Varanasi, during our stay in Sarnath, Terry and I visited the Tibetan Gompa and the Ladakhi Rest House, neither of which had been there a few years ago. Indeed, since the time of my earliest visits to the place, a kind of cantonment had sprung up between the end of the road on which stood the Mahabodhi Society's rest house and the new railway station. At the Ladakhi Rest House, I had a pleasant talk with the young monk in charge, who turned out to be a relation of Kusho Bakula, the incarnate lama who was present at my bhikshu ordination in 1959. I also met some of the Ladakhi boys who had once spent their summer holidays with me in Kalimpong, having been brought there by Lama Lobsang, their then mentor, another relation of Kusho Bakula's, and who now attended the Mahabodhi High School. The Tibetan Gompa and the Ladakhi Rest House were not the only recent additions to the attractions and amenities of Sarnath. There was also an open-air tea shop. Terry and I patronised it more than once, sitting at one of the little tables, sipping our strong, sweet Indian tea and contemplating the passing scene. At other tables sat Buddhist pilgrims of various nationalities, middle-class Hindu day trippers from Varanasi, and occasionally a Western tourist or two. Once we saw 4 or 5 American hippies, one of them a woman with a baby, long-haired, emaciated and half-naked, and seemingly under the influence of drugs, they moved mechanically from table to table, soliciting alms. Some of the Indians they approached were evidently shocked to see white people begging, and gave, when they did give, as much out of embarrassment as generosity. For my part, I felt sorry for the poor hippies, the first I had seen. They did not look very happy, and though I could understand their rejection of conventional values, a rejection that was soon to become widespread among young people in the West, I also saw that because of their inability to replace those values by real ones, they had lost their way and were simply drifting. Though there was much for us to do and see at Sarnath, Terry and I did not forget our friends in England. Many letters and postcards had been sent from Ahmedabad and other places along the way, and in Sarnath we wrote more of them than ever. Terry wrote to his parents and to Vivian, Alan, Viria and other friends. I wrote to Tien Chow, Viria and Francoise, to my mother, to Maurice and Ruth Walsh, to each of the 3 Musketeers, to Christmas Humphreys and to sundry other members of the Sangha Association and the Buddhist Society. I also wrote to our hosts and other friends in Bombay, Ahmedabad, Pune and Nagpur, thanking them for their hospitality and cooperation, as well as to friends I was expecting to meet in Bodh Gaya, Calcutta and Kalimpong, alerting them to my impending arrival with Terry. Among those in Kalimpong to whom I wrote was Shramanir Thubden, one of the two young Tibetans whom I had left in charge of the Triyana Vardhana Vihara. He was of a very serviceable disposition, and as soon as he heard I was in Sarnath, he came and joined me there in order to be of assistance, arriving from Calcutta 2 days before Terry and I were due to leave for Bodh Gaya. The following day there was a ceremonial food offering to the monastic order in memory of Venerable Sasanasiri. About 30 Theravadin bhikkhus were duly fed, and about 50 Tibetan monks, including Thubden. Among the bhikkhus who happened to be in Sarnath that day, there were several from Thailand. One of them, Sukhiti by name, was known to me, and after the meal I invited him and his companions to my room, where we talked for a while about the progress of Buddhism in the West. On the morning of our last day in Sarnath, Terry took a few pictures. We had our last cup of tea at the open-air tea shop and had a long talk with Sangharatana and Dharmarakshita, the only Indian member of the Sarnath monastic community. Both men were very worried, especially Sangharatana. For the last year or more, the Varanasi-based Hindi press had been conducting against the Mahabodhi Society monks and against Sangharatana in particular, a campaign of systematic abuse and vilification. Hardly a day passed without allegations being made by one or other of the numerous Hindu-owned and Hindu-edited dailies and weeklies. What those allegations were, Sangharatana did not say, but knowing the depths to which the vernacular press was capable of sinking, I did not need to ask. In recent weeks, the campaign had reached such a pitch that the Mahabodhi Society's governing body in Calcutta, fearing that the organisation's reputation and standing were being jeopardised, had started putting pressure on Sangharatana to leave Sarnath. He did not want to leave Sarnath, he told me passionately, almost in tears, but it was beginning to look as though he would be forced to do so. When I left for Bodh Gaya that afternoon with Terry and Thubden, it was therefore with a feeling of sadness on Sangharatana's account, and with the reflection that, now, as in the Buddha's day, in their efforts to retard or roll back the wheel of the Dharma, Mara and his agents would stop at nothing. In Bodh Gaya we stayed at the rather splendid Thai temple built by the Thai government in traditional style a few years earlier. I had stayed there once or twice before and was acquainted with several of the resident monks. Though I had not visited Bodh Gaya as often as Sarnath, my memories of the former two were of a composite nature, and I had a distinct recollection of only two visits. Naturally, my first visit, which took place in the winter of 1949-50, in the company of Venerable Sangharatana, was one of these. On that occasion, I'd been deeply moved and felt like bursting into a paean in celebration of the beauties of the great pilgrimage centre, as I actually did long afterwards when writing about the visit. The other visit, of which I have a distinct recollection, took place about 10 years later. I was travelling with Bhikkhu Vivekananda, my closest friend among the Thai monks, and we had taken a cycle rickshaw from Gaya station to Bodh Gaya. We did not reach our destination until after midnight and found the place completely deserted. Even the roadside boutiques were closed and a profound silence reigned. As we neared the Mahabodhi temple, the central tower of which was silhouetted against the starry sky, to our astonishment, we saw that in every niche of the great building, as well as on the numerous votive stupas by which it was surrounded, a little oil lamp was burning. There must have been thousands of lamps. So tranquil was the scene that it was not difficult to believe They had been placed there in worship of the Buddha, not by any human agency, but by the invisible hands of devas. At the Thai temple, a stricter discipline prevailed than at the Mahabodhi monastery in Sarnath. Bhikkhus, novices and laymen were all rigidly separated. They were accommodated separately and ate separately. This meant that Terry and I did not see each other at meals or in the evening. The rest of the day we passed together as usual, circumambulating the temple and paying our respects to the Bodhi tree, to the Vajrasana, or diamond throne on which the Buddha gained enlightenment, and to the life-sized image of the master that dominated the gloomy, candle-lit inner shrine. As it was winter, and the pilgrimage and tourist season was in full swing, the sacred site was a crowded and sometimes noisy place. Indeed, it was much noisier and more crowded than I remembered it as having been on any of my previous visits. Not only were there hundreds more pilgrims and tourists, but in the interval, many more boutiques and stalls had sprung up. During the 2 days that we were in Bodh Gaya, Terry and I therefore spent less time in and around the Mahabodhi temple than on the shores of a nearby lake in which there grew many water lilies. While Terry took photographs, I contemplated the pink blossoms that rose here and there from among the dark green leaves. According to the scriptures, the Buddha, shortly after his enlightenment, had seen such a lake, not indeed of pink water lilies, but of blue, red or white lotuses. Some of the lotuses he saw throve in the water without coming out of it. Some rested on the surface of the water, and some, coming right up out of the water, stood clear of the water, unwetted by it. So seeing, the scriptures relate, he saw beings with little dust on their eyes and with much dust on their eyes, with keen faculties and dull faculties, with good qualities and bad qualities, easy to teach and hard to teach, and some who dwelt seeing fear in the other world and blame as well. Thus seeing, he decided not to remain silent, as hitherto he had been inclined to do, but rather to communicate the truth he had discovered. The doors of the deathless were now wide open, and those who heard him had only to put forth their faith. Perhaps it was while he was walking or sitting on the shores of this very lake that the Buddha had decided to teach. The Thai temple was not the only new building in Bodh Gaya. Besides the Mahabodhi Society's modest rest house, several other temples and monasteries had been erected there in recent times, that is to say, since the restoration of the site by British archaeologists towards the end of the 19th century. One of these was the Tibetan Gompa, the horizontal lines of which were in striking contrast to the more vertical lines of its colourful Thai neighbour. Here we met a lama who happened to know me, and were amused to see that in front of one of the images in the main chapel there had been placed for the enlightenment of tourists a sign which read, "God Buddha." We also visited the Samanvaya Ashram, built 10 years earlier by Vinoba Bhave, the venerable follower of Mahatma Gandhi, in order to, quote, increase the importance of Bodh Gaya in the eyes of the world. At this institution we met Munindra Barua, a practitioner of insight meditation, whom I had known since 1949, and with whom I had had more than one lively discussion about the merits of this controversial new Burmese technique. With him there were two Western novices, Yasa and Sariputta by name, the one German, the other Swiss. The pair had come to see me in Bombay and told me on that occasion that they had spent 7 years in the East and that the experience had proved a disappointing one. Since then they had visited to Kalimpong and were now apparently on pilgrimage in Bodh Gaya before finally returning to Europe. Back at the Thai temple, I talked about meditation with my roommate and had a long discussion with the Lord Abbot, as he was styled, about the progress of Buddhism in England. I must have mentioned that many English Buddhists were vegetarians, for in the course of our exchange, it transpired that the Lord Abbot was a decided opponent of vegetarianism, both the principle and practice of which he clearly regarded as being very un-Buddhistic. His attitude did not really surprise me, for I knew that the vast majority of Thai monks were inveterate meat-eaters and would go to any lengths of rationalisation to justify their fondness for pork and chicken. At the Thai temple itself, even the simplest dishes were mixed with meat, so that whether at breakfast or at lunch, both Ekapano, the temple's sole resident vegetarian, and I found it difficult to get enough to eat. Since the Lord Abbot was senior to me in ordination, and I was moreover a guest, I made no attempt to defend the cause of vegetarianism, especially as I knew that in any case very few Thai monks were open to conviction on the subject. My most interesting encounter was with Venerable Dhammajoti, one of the Mahabodhi Society monks who had been so unwilling to adorn Satyapriya and me all those years ago. Terry and I came across him in the course of one of our circumambulations. He was performing a puja beneath the Bodhi tree and had with him a small Sinhalese boy. The boy was a medium, Dhammajoti explained, and the late Anagarika Dhammapala, who had been reborn in one of the higher heavenly worlds, spoke through him. Anagarika Dhammapala was, of course, the founder of the Mahabodhi Society, and he had spent much of his life trying to wrest ownership of the Bodh Gaya temple from the mercenary Hindu Mahant, whose predecessors gained possession of the site after it was sacked by the Muslim invaders. Though he may indeed have been reborn as a deva, and though I did not altogether disbelieve in the possibility of mediumship, the idea of the Anagarika communicating with his disciples in such a manner was somehow distasteful to me, and I found it difficult to accept Dhammajoti's claim. During our stay in Bodh Gaya, Terry was consistently cheerful, and he remained cheerful at least for the next 2 or 3 days, in the course of which we concluded our pilgrimage to the sacred sites by visiting Rajgir and Nalanda. At Rajgir, we saw the caves associated, respectively, with Mahakashyapa, the most ascetic of the Buddha's disciples, and with the so-called First Council. We also climbed to the top of the Vulture's Peak, where, according to tradition, the Buddha had revealed the White Lotus Sutra, one of the most important Mahayana scriptures. At Nalanda, we explored the extensive and immense remains of the great Buddhist monastic university, visited the museum, and talked with the students and professors of the university's modest modern successor, the Nalanda Pali Institute, founded by Venerable Kashyap in the previous decade. Kashyapji himself was not at the institute when Terry and I arrived, but he came some hours later. And that evening and the following morning, my old teacher and I had a long talk. In the course of the talk, he gave his blessing to my plan of returning permanently to the West and working for Buddhism there. He gave it all the more readily for his being very disappointed with conditions in India, where little remained of the idealism that had inspired the independence movement, and for his being pessimistic about the future of the Dharma in the land of its birth. For my own part, I was glad to have seen Kashyapji again, and glad to have received his blessing as I entered upon the next stage of my life and work as a Buddhist. 36 hours later, having returned to Bodh Gaya for the night, my friend and I, accompanied by Thubten, left Gaya for Calcutta at 8:30 in the evening by the Dun Express. Our little party reached Howrah Station on the morning of the 13th of November, exactly 12 hours after leaving Gaya. Soon we were in a taxi on our way to the Mahabodhi Society's headquarters in College Square, where we were welcomed by my old acquaintance, Venerable Jinaratana, who, like Sarnath-based Sangharatana, was one of the Society's two joint secretaries.